Okay, everybody, this episode's probably going to be more interesting and possibly even more fun and informative than my last two episodes that I recorded. And it's going to be more, you know, detailed, in-depth, better researched. I have more thorough notes on it and stuff. Well, it's basically an exploration of the differences between Leninism and Marx's socialism. And also we're going to look at where socialism and communism come from, just a little bit of that. And it all started with me answering a Quora question. What is the difference between Marx and Lenin in five sentences? So here's how I originally answered that. I said Marx laid the theoretical foundation for communism through his analysis of capitalist society, focusing on the inevitable class struggle leading to the overthrow of the bourgeoisie by the proletariat. He envisioned a spontaneous, practical revolution arising from the contradictions inherent in capitalism. Lenin, on the other hand, adapted Marx's theories to the conditions of early 20th century Russia, advocating for a vanguard party to guide the revolution due to the country's lack of a mature capitalist class. Lenin emphasized the need for centralized leadership and a professional revolutionary cadre to seize power and establish a dictatorship of the proletariat. To subject the insurrection of the proletarian and non-proletarian masses to our influence, to our direction, to use it in our best interests. Quote, while Marx provided the theoretical framework, Lenin's practical application of Marxism resulted in the Bolshevik Revolution and the formation of the Soviet Union, which significantly influenced the course of 20th century history. So all of that is pretty much, you know, like just straightforward textbook stuff. Nothing too controversial as far as I'm concerned in that straightforward reading. I think it's fair what I said. And to understand how they differ, you know, you can compare their ideas. You know, Marx developed a theory based on, you know, European capitalist society in the 19th century. Lenin applied the theory, or his variety of the theory, and it dealt with Russian capitalist society in the early 20th century, which, of course, makes it different from Marx right off the bat. You're talking about two different centuries. There's bound to be some differences, you know, even regardless of differences between their two ideas and approaches. So comparing differences between these two people can help us learn about ideologies that shaped world politics during the 20th century and beyond. So it's very fun and potentially mind-blowing to ask what is the difference between Lenin's socialism and Marx's socialism. So they share some fundamental ideas, but they also have, you know, the distinct differences. You know, Lenin believed in the vanguard party, which I touched upon, you know, in my core answer, but I'm going to go into a greater depth here. Lenin introduced the concept of the vanguard party, which is a small disciplined party of professional revolutionaries who lead the proletariat in overthrowing the capitalist system. He viewed this as an advanced yet practical approach. You know, sort of the best of both worlds. It was more sophisticated yet also more down to earth. Marx did not explicitly advocate for such a party, at least not to my knowledge, although he did acknowledge the necessity of organization and leadership in the working class movement. Though it's debatable whether organization and leadership necessitates or constitutes a party per se, some will say it does, others will probably say there are points of distinction to be made, and I'm sure there are, you know, especially if you want to be overly categorical about things. And they had differences of view in the role of the state. Lenin believed in the necessity of a strong, centralized state to guide the transition from capitalism to socialism. Even if he didn't feel it was necessary to define socialism, you know, like, even if he didn't feel the state was necessary as a way to define socialism, he felt it was necessary to actualize it. He argued that the proletariat needed to seize control of the state apparatus to suppress the bourgeoisie and defend the gains of the revolution. This seemed to take on more importance than the withering away of the state that Marx had talked about. You know, that's one of the reasons that Stalinism was able to happen. Marx indeed envisaged the eventual withering away of the state under communism, where the state would no longer be necessary as class distinctions dissolve. On that note, the withering away of the state is a Marxist concept first coined by Friedrich Engels, who was sort of Marx's, you know, like the Robin to Marx's Batman, in a way. Engels, he posited that after a certain point, the interference of state power and social relations becomes superfluous in one sphere after another, and then ceases of itself. It just stops. The government of persons is replaced by the administration of things and the direction of the process of production. The state is not abolished, it withers away. Those were, you know, translated words. So, of course, some meaning might have been lost in translation there. The English translation sounds a little bit clunky, but nevertheless, I think the point gets across. And, of course, there were differences in how Marx and Lenin viewed the dictatorship of the proletariat. Both Lenin and Marx advocated for the dictatorship of the proletariat as a transitional stage towards communism. Lenin described some of this process as diversity in discussion and unity in action, but we all know that it famously wound up being a personality and party worship cult under Stalinism. You know, I mean, that's just the way things went. So again, both Lenin and Marx believed in the dictatorship of the proletariat. However, Lenin interpreted this concept as the rule of the vanguard party acting on behalf of the proletariat, while Marx seemingly conceived it as direct proletarian rule without the need for a separate party. Although I'm sure some of you out there might have a different view on that. Maybe I'm totally wrong, but that's what I've gathered about it. And they may have had some different views on imperialism, too. Lenin developed the theory of imperialism as the highest stage of capitalism, arguing that monopoly capitalism leads to increased exploitation and conflict between capitalist nations. Lenin rather correctly said the First World War, you know, between 1914 and 1918, was, quote, an annexationist, predatory, plunderous war. And I would be hard-pressed to disagree with him on that point. Marx did not specifically elaborate on imperialism that much, although his analysis of capitalism's inherent contradictions laid the groundwork for Lenin's theory. And there may be some detectable distinctions in how they viewed revolutionary strategy. Lenin's strategy focused on the possibility of revolutionary action in less advanced, predominantly agrarian societies such as Russia, and he no doubt viewed that as practical in order to create the change that he desired. He argued that a revolutionary vanguard could seize power in these less advanced countries and serve as a catalyst for international revolution. And of course, countries like the United States regarded that as the domino effect. They had their own theory about it in the counter-revolutionary sense. So Marx, on the other hand, saw the industrialized nations as the primary agents of revolution due to their advanced capitalist development. And they no doubt also had different views on the transition to socialism. Lenin proposed the New Economic Policy, or the NEP, as a temporary measure to reintroduce limited market mechanisms in the Soviet Union after the devastation of the Civil War. Lenin characterized the NEP in 1922 as an economic system that would include a free market and capitalism, both subject to state control, while socialized state enterprises would operate on a profit basis. This represented a departure from Marx's vision of a more direct transition from capitalism to socialism. While Lenin built upon Marx's ideas and adapted them to the specific conditions of his time, there are notable differences between Leninism and Marx in terms of socialism and the revolutionary strategy, the rule of the state, and the nature of proletarian dictatorship. So to keep things interesting, I want to discuss also where these communist ideas came from in the first place, and socialism, and maybe this analysis will help some people understand that these ideas didn't just fall out of the sky or emerge from the depths of hell, you know. Neither heaven nor hell could adequately explain them. So, the development of industrial capitalism led to more employment opportunities and higher wages, especially if you look at the storybook version of how it came to be. However, the so-called private nature of the economy also created new problems, such as increasing unemployment among workers who were unable to afford housing or food and risk losing everything as they lack property and resources and therefore lack equal decision-making power under a more privately managed economy. So the worse this problem is, the more there is a perception of class warfare against the working class, and that continues to this day. For an example of the ideological need for the upper classes to antagonize the working class, consider how right-wingers and so-called centrists want to make so much assistance to citizens contingent on things like work requirements, often based on stereotypes of workers just needing help because they're too damn lazy otherwise, you know? The state can, you know, engage in corporate welfare and often does so through the military-industrial complex. But, you know, if you're just a regular working person and you need help, well, you gotta jump through a bunch of weird hoops that are often insulting, you know? So as the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities noted on March 15th, 2023, you know, in reality, this is a quote now, in reality, black women have the highest labor force participation rate among adult women, and black, Asian, and Latina women work at higher rates than white women. So the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says that work requirements are also based on an outdated understanding of disability that treats people as either completely unable to work or able-bodied with no work limitations. So they argue that requiring people to show compliance with a work requirement also ignores the impacts of structural racism on people's employment opportunities and outcomes. In other words, you know, this is me talking now. In other words, some people may be outright denied employment due simply to racism, or even if you wish to take race out of the picture, simply for lacking social connections or education, maybe looking a certain way, having a certain kind of name, and a certain kind of reputation, or lacking unique qualifications. You know, there's all kinds of stuff that can be figured into that. So, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities say work requirements can reinforce, quote, a false view that people receiving assistance from economic security and health programs are individually and solely responsible for their circumstances, lack agency to manage their lives, and if compelled to work, will be lifted out of poverty. end quote. So, you know, that's kind of a glimpse into the issues that are facing the working class, in this case in America, but, you know, that could be extended globally, those types of issues and approaches. And so in response to, you know, the hardships that they faced, many Europeans back in the heyday of communism began to organize movements against what was considered unfair exploitation. These included trade unions like the Socialist Party, and socialism has most of its well-established modern roots back in the 1800s, though such sentiments existed earlier. Socialism and associated ideas often appealed to workers, who often, despite having working-class pride, nevertheless harbored some perhaps buried resentments regarding their lives spent either working in the fields or being sent down to work in the mines or in the dark satanic mills, as they were sometimes called, or factories whose chimneys appeared to be puffing out sinister smoke. You know, they even looked like some kind of evil place in a lot of cases. So it looks even bleaker when people realize that the capitalists are actually working together with the government, its leaders, and various social institutions, who have agreed to not take action in ways to help people better put food on the table or pay their rent and other bills and stuff like that, you know? And of course, if you're in a situation where you're basically literally starving to death or not far from it, you're going to have even more reason to consider some radical approach to change. If the status quo does little to improve living standards for those affected by largely private ownership of the economy, something like the emergence of communism as a major political force, in this case in the 1900s, really shouldn't be all that surprising. In fact, despite what American media might have you believe, nostalgia for the good old days of the Soviet Union is actually growing in Russia, apparently. And that's, you know, if you want to know what I'm talking about, this is according to a Pew Research Center poll from 2019. They saw that more than 6 in 10 Russians agree with the statement, "It is a great misfortune that the Soviet Union no longer exists." So again, that's 6 in 10 Russians. Well, technically more than 6 in 10. So, I mean, what does that tell you about the power of these ideas? You know, it's not just that they had a history, because obviously if that history had been nothing but terrible for everybody involved, it would simply be forgotten. Like, people wouldn't want to go back to it at all, ever. But, you know, ideas both good and bad, they retain their appeal for one reason or another. And the idea of socialism partly also became popular following World War I, because that war sparked widespread discontentment among soldiers returning home. And some socialists formed parties dedicated to bringing down governments through political means rather than violence. Others were more outright violent revolutionaries in their ideas, rhetoric, and their approaches. Though some individuals in these movements had racist or otherwise xenophobic or hateful beliefs, they were still largely progressive movements in their day, and you know, especially innovative, you know, in those terms, like for example, Emma Goldman, you know, the anarcho-communist from back in the, you know, 30s, or the 20s and 30s, she actually spoke about, you know, gay people and that sort of stuff way back then, when practically nobody else was doing that. So, you know, these people were the progressives of their time, by and large. So Europeans had similar concerns when it came to inequality within countries and across borders. You know, They believed in, you know, as the saying goes, building bridges and not building walls. They saw capitalist states as extractive states looking to expand and exploit people on a global basis, and therefore felt the need for some increased global unity against these exploiters. It's not entirely different from how many Europeans and other nations joined forces in order to fight imperialistic powers to protect national sovereignty. You know, only the socialist or communist movements were not so much about national sovereignty as they were about international solidarity, and quite often that would put them at odds with nationalism. So, you know, I think I've said enough here, but on a future day I will probably go into the possible differences between communism and socialism. But I covered a lot of ground here today, so, you know, have a nice day. Maybe you learned a thing or two. I don't know.